Now this is Tuesday night, November the 25th. And we think we will start out our lesson tonight a little bit differently than usual. We don't very often get into the Old Testament, and we have spent some time too back in the historical part. We haven't paid too much attention to the prophets, for one thing, and we had some time back studied up until we came to the dedication of the temple. That is 405 B.C., after the 70 years captivity and servitude and desolations. Now, during the time of the captivity, they had a couple of prophets that were very helpful to the people, Ezekiel especially, telling about their future glories and the new Jerusalem, the millennial Jerusalem, and so on. But down, well, you see the decree to rebuild the temple was given in 454 B.C. And Nehemiah was made governor and was to go ahead and do the work. He made several trips from Babylon to Jerusalem. And 454 to 405, you see, made 49 years. Now that period of time in a prophecy in Daniel 9, or yes, Daniel 9, 25, was spoken of as a period of unrest and so on, and it surely was. The building of the temple itself was delayed about 15 years because the people got discouraged. There weren't too many people who went back to Jerusalem in the first place. And when Cyrus, the son of Ahasuerus and Esther, made the proclamation that all who wished to go back could go back, there weren't a great many. The faithfulness had rather left them. After all, a total of more than 70 years of all of it changed a lot of things. And of course, you know, in any period of time, there can be great changes in 70 years. And being away from their city, Jerusalem, and finally finding out that it lay in ruins and the temple had been burned and so on, and that way back, a way long way from Babylon, well, there weren't very many hardy souls that were willing to make the trip and to do all of that work. And so Nehemiah and Ezra didn't have very good luck in getting a large following to go back and do that work. And when they did, they got discouraged. Now, during the latter part of that period, beginning with about 410 B.C., there were two prophets given to the people who had been in the land, and the city is just about ready to, well, the city is pretty well built. The temple wasn't finished until 405. Two prophets were brought up, Zechariah and Haggai. Now, both of them began just about the same time. Haggai's prophecy, and that's just before Zechariah in your Bible, he only prophesied about 4 months, but he covered quite a little bit of territory, but it was to be a sort of encouragement to these people. And he speaks especially of their building the temple, and Zechariah is talking more about the building of the city and also looking forward to the glories of Jerusalem in the future. Now, Zechariah, just in the passing, is sort of divided up into a series of eight visions. And that occupies the first few chapters. And I haven't made an attempt yet to put those on the structure just to see how they'd be. And I haven't found anybody that has attempted it. Maybe I'll try that some of these days. But I don't care to go into it just too deeply like that and so on. We don't have time. It takes a lot of time to do work like that, and we don't have more than about one period a week to do this study. So the first six verses are sort of introductory, and let's read those first six verses of Zechariah. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying, The Lord hath been sore displeased with your fathers. Well, now, we get a little bit of the characters and the time and so on here in this. That may be some help. Now, we have Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, and he was the son of Iddo, the prophet. And as we study a little bit about the lives of these, find out about them, we find that Berechiah didn't live very long, and therefore he didn't take over the prophetic office, as we might say. And so really Zechariah followed his grandfather Iddo. And so he starts out here saying, well, the Lord hath been sore displeased with your fathers. Therefore say unto them, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Turn ye unto me, or repent, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. And I said, you know, that they had delayed their building of this temple and so on. They'd gotten discouraged and they'd lost about 15 years. However, that 15 years had been counted in the prophecy when Daniel made his prophecy and said it would be 49 years from the decree until the dedication of the temple. So Daniel knew what he was talking about, didn't he? And he says in verse 4, Be not as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets have cried, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Turn ye now from your evil ways and from your evil doings. Turn ye, the same as repent. But they did not hear, nor hearken unto me, saith the Lord. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? Well, they come and they go. And your fathers, well, where are they? Well, a lot of them have perished in the captivity. They're gone. And verse 6, But my words, my statutes, which I commanded my servants the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? And they returned and said, Like as the Lord of hosts thought to do unto us, according to our ways and according to our doings, so hath he dealt with us. You know, whenever you go to studying the history of Israel, and you can start it with Abraham and take it right on through till you get through the prophets, you wonder so much failure. And you wish that the story came out better. That's more like some of our fairy stories, you know, we tell sometimes, and they usually are pretty good and they come out right and everything, but somehow these true-to-life stories in the Bible don't always come out just right, do they? And yet, at the bottom, if you find the prophetic thread, it all comes out all right. Even in spite of the failures of all of the fathers. Now, here is your first vision. And now, remember, this is in about 410 B.C. A little over 400 years before Christ was born. Upon the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month Sebat, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet, saying, I saw by night, and behold, a man riding upon a red horse, and he, notice this, and he, which the man or the horse or both. Doesn't this make you think of the centaurs? Well, they had a signification too. The centaurs, as you find two of them in the signs of the zodiac, represent Christ. Here he says, I saw by night, and behold, a man riding upon a red horse, and he stood among the myrtle trees that were in the bottom. Now, myrtle trees are not the oaks that grow on the mountains, or the stately cedars, and so on. They represent Israel. They were a finer tree, that is, they weren't stalwart and strong like the oaks. They grew in the shaded places and the sheltered places, and so a little like Israel. And says in the bottom, now that doesn't mean what we mean usually by bottom nowadays. I've always been told a bottom is the low land along a creek or a river. Always call it creek bottom or river bottom. And usually pretty good land, raise lots of corn and so on, likely to flood. But this is between a couple of mountains, sort of in the shade and protected. And there he was, riding on a red horse, and behind him were there red horses, speckled and white. Now, I'm not going to interpret all of these. You have notes in your companion Bible, and they will give you some ideas, although sometimes, for the very best of scholars, these are more or less guesswork. Of course, when all of these things are fulfilled, then it will be plain, everything will be known. Well, then said I, O my Lord, what are these? And the angel that talked with me said unto me, I will show thee what these be. And the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom the Lord has sent to walk to and fro through the earth. Walk to and fro through the earth. Now, that, of course, is probably for seeing what's going on, checking, and so forth. We have something about an expression like that in Job. For Satan was asked what he was doing. They said, oh, he was walking to and fro on the earth. He's looking about to see what he can get into. That wasn't the case here. They were checking and so on, because angels, you see, are ministering spirits there as a salvation. Have to do with Israel. And they answered the angel of the Lord. Now, when you see the word angel of the Lord, you can usually figure it as Jehovah. And they answered the angel of the Lord, who stood among the myrtle trees, and said, we have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. Well, Israel weren't at rest. Talking about the nations. Remember that Israel's in captivity, or had been in captivity, and had been released and gone to their land, and still they weren't left alone. They had been tormented and tortured by the folks, I'm using that figuratively, all the time they were trying to build it. All the folk had tried to interfere, and so on. And even Darius about forgot what he was going to do and help, and so on. He had to be reminded. And so all the nations about, and so on, everything seemed to be going along all right. But it wasn't true of the myrtle trees, Israel. Then the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah against which thou hast had indignation these 70 years? Well, here is a question. The angel of the Lord. Is this Christ then again, who is a sort of an intercessor? And speaking of the Father, to the Father, and how long that thou not hath mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah against Prince Thomas' indignation, these 70 years, the 70 years. And the Lord answered the angel that talked with me with good words and of comfortable words. So the angel that communed with me said unto me, Cry thou, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy. Now this word jealous is not exactly, doesn't exactly have the same meaning as we think of. It means that he has a great interest in them, loves them, so on, and is anxious to see that they have blessings and that they make progress and so on. They are his people. And especially Jerusalem for Zion. As I said, Haggai is talking about the temple, and here Zechariah is talking a great deal just about the city of Zion and what's happening to it. And I'm going on with that. And I am very sore displeased with the heathen, here it brings it out, that are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and ye helped forward the affliction. And they helped forward the affliction. In other words, these nations had been used of God to afflict Israel to punish them. And it sounds here as if they had gone further than God had intended. So he says in verse 16, Therefore thus saith the Lord, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it. That is a temple, saith the Lord. The Lord of hosts. My cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad. And the Lord shall yet comfort Zion and shall yet choose Jerusalem. Now this is your introduction so far. The first 16 verses. And, well, I'm 17 is what it is. All right. Now, that's the first vision that we have here and the application of it. And that takes us down to verse 18. Now, his first vision again was the man on a red horse and the myrtle trees. So, that gives you that picture. Now, in verse 18, taking up the second vision, And lifted I up mine eyes and saw, and behold, four horns. Now, horns are symbolical throughout all the heathen countries. Israel and so on too. A horn usually is symbolical of strength. In the visions of Daniel, they represented kingdoms. You remember that there was a ram that had two horns, and one was a little larger than the other, Medo-Persia. And there was the goat that had one horn, Greece, one horn symbolizing the power of Alexander. And that was broken off, and four other horns came up, and that was the generals of Alexander who took over the kingdom after him. And in the heathen mythologies and idols and stuff, quite often you see their gods having horns. Sometimes one, sometimes two, sometimes a whole bunch. Now we do have a picture in the prophecy of Daniel of that fourth kingdom, and there was a nondescript beast that had 10 horns. Then the 11th came up when I was broken out. We have the same thing repeated in the prophecies and the Revelation. Horns then representing power, kingdoms, and so on. And so here, Zechariah lifts up his eyes and saw four horns. Four kingdoms. Now, as to whom these kingdoms might be, this Gentile powers, I don't know. I have seen a list of 8 of them, out of which you might fix the 4. And it makes no difference. And I said unto the angel, talk with me, well, what be these? And he answered me, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. So these are the powers that had scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. Now, we couldn't apply that too well to the 4 kingdoms of Daniel 2, although we might. If that is true, then it'd be Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. If that were true. Well, as I say, I don't know. I'm not too particularly interested exactly in those. They are those who scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And the Lord showed me 4 carpenters. 4 horns and 4 carpenters. Those are ironsmiths. Those who put the iron on an anvil and beat it into shape, take out the impurities and so on. In fact, back in those days, a good blacksmith could make a piece of steel with the forge and the anvil. Nowadays, why, we put it in a furnace and burn the carbon out. But he would put the iron in the furnace and get it good and hot and then start beating it with a hammer. And he'd put it back and get it hot again, keep doing that and beating it until finally got the carbon burned out of it and got it so he could make it malleable, as we say. He could do something with it. And they could make such a pure steel sword by just that, those ancient ironsmiths, or blacksmiths we call them, that sword could be bent with the tip coming clear back and hitting the hilt, and it'd snap back into place. Pretty good steel. If it had any carbon in it, it'd snap. So that was real steel they could make back in those days. Damascus was famous for its swords. In later years, during the Middle Ages, Toledo, Spain, was noted for its swords, called Toledo blades. And by the way, I used to live in the city of Toledo, Ohio, and they had a newspaper there, and it was called the Toledo Blade. So, you see, no danger of forgetting it. Well, then said I, well, what come these to do? He just doesn't know. And he spake, saying, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, so no man did lift up his head. But these are come to fray, that is to scare, and to scatter them, to cast out the horns of the Gentiles, which lifted up their horn over the land of Judah to scatter it. So now there are 4 carpenters, and who? I don't know. A little note here in your companion Bible, and it may not help much, but give you an idea of what's driving it. Said these, that is, these 4 smiths, or it may denote the supernatural princes over the kingdoms, they represent the divine agencies raised up by which Jehovah will overthrow them. And that's all the note we have on that. I think you'll begin to see as we read prophecy that a great deal of it is not too easily made known or known, and of course some reason for that, because God is not pinpointing everything in his prophecies from the fact that men have a choice. So God is giving the outline of what men will do. Sometimes he's very particular. A couple of times he has named men in prophecy before they were even born and told what we're going to do. Cyrus was one of them. And it comes and goes, but as we notice all the way through that God does not interfere with a man's choice. Now that's strange, but that is one of the rights that's given a man, is to make a choice of what he will do. Of course, now they may choose to do the wrong thing and get smashed for it. And that's what some of these heathen have done. All right, that is then your vision number two. And this is horns, four horns, and four blacksmiths. Now, chapter two. And we take up the third vision. I lift up my eyes again and looked, and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. A measuring line. Oh, he must have been a surveyor or something like that. Then said I, well, whither goest thou? And he said unto me, to measure Jerusalem, to see what is the breadth thereof, and what is the length thereof. Now, I don't know the entire significance of this, but we do find back in chapter 11 of the Revelation that John, the Revelator, was to take a line, a rod this time, not a line, but a rod, and measure the temple in Jerusalem. And it was to be measured for judgment. And there were some of it to be measured and some of it not to be measured. The court of the Gentiles was not to be measured. It was the main part of it because it had to do with Israel. And measuring usually ends up in a judgment. And so here, Jerusalem is to be measured. Now remember, Jerusalem has just been rebuilt. Maybe they're working on some yet. And the temple is being rebuilt. And he is to measure Jerusalem. As I said, that has some idea of some judgment or something. And behold, the angel that talked with me went forth, and another angel went out to meet him, and said unto him, run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls, for the multitude of men and cattle therein. Someday a great population. Well, now, the walls of Jerusalem have been extended. The old walls are mostly still there, but new walls include more territory. But here, it's going to spread to the place that they'd be outside of the walls as well. Well, I think that is a great deal of the situation today. The walls of Jerusalem don't amount to a great deal today like they did in olden times. With the modern artillery we have and so on, a wall like that wouldn't last long. So as a means of fortification, a wall like they used to have doesn't last very long. Well, he says, run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls, for the multitude of men and cattle therein. For I, saith the Lord, will be unto her a wall of fire round about her, and will be the glory in the midst of her. Instead of needing a wall, he will be himself, Jehovah, will be a wall of fire around Jerusalem and protect her in that day. And will be the glory in the midst of her. Now, we do know that there will have no need of the sun and the moon in the new Jerusalem, but don't believe that's what he's talking about here yet, although there will be a glorious time in the millennial Jerusalem. Well, he says here, ho, ho, come forth and flee from the land of the north, saith the Lord, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven, saith the Lord. Deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwellest with the daughter of Babylon. That sounds almost like come out of her, doesn't it? That's another expression we have, coming out of Babylon. Once Israel had nothing to do with Babylon. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you, for he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. And that has been from the time of Abraham up until this time. That's a lot of years. For Abraham was told way back in the 1400s B.C. that God would bless those that blessed him and would curse those that cursed him. Now, if you know what it means here, did you ever have anybody poke their finger into your eye? You know how that hurts. Now, that is the fear the Lord uses here, that somebody, anybody, who would mistreat Israel, God's people, they like sticking their finger in God's eye, an apple of his eye. Well, this will probably help explain the fierceness sometimes of the judgment that comes upon nations who meddle with Israel. And he goes on to say in verse 9, "For behold, I will shape mine hand upon them, and they shall be a spoil to their servants, and ye shall know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for lo, I come, and I dwell in the midst of thee, saith the Lord." Now that's a future. A long time, because it hasn't come yet. He came, they rejected him, but someday he will come and dwell in the midst of them. Now this is quite a comfort to these people who have been discouraged, coming back to build their city and their temple, and don't know what to do. "And many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people. And I will dwell in the midst of thee, and thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent thee unto thee. And the Lord shall inherit Judah, his portion in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. Be silent, O flesh, before the Lord, for he is raised up out of his holy habitation." Well, that's quite a comfort to his people, that he will come someday and personally dwell in the midst of them. Jerusalem. I saw an expression here, or did I? Or was it before this? When I'm reading along, sometimes my thoughts wander. Oh, yeah, the Holy Land. You don't find that expression very often. I know one man told me some time back that he believed that land was about the most unholy land today. That's something to think about. Well, "Be silent, O all flesh, before the Lord, for he has raised us up, for he has raised up out of his holy habitation." In other words, he's going to step out and do something. Now we're getting down to Vision 4, chapter 3. Now let's see here. In this vision we just had, 3, there's a measuring line. We'll keep these straight. And the application. Now in verse chapter 3, we have the fourth one. "And he showed me Joshua, the high priest." And we won't go into all of that. You'll find in Haggai 1:1. This was a high priest. "And he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord." Angel of the Lord. Well, again, quite often this means Jehovah. and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. Well, let's see, Joshua standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his, that is, the angel's right hand to resist him. That reminds me of Romans, where it speaks about who shall make any accusation. And it says it is Christ that is the advocate. He's the one who is doing the work. Well, the advocate stands at the right hand instead of the accuser. And here's the picture. Usually the accuser stands at the right hand of the judge. But that is taken by the Lord as the advocate. Well, here we have Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. And Satan, of course, means the accuser or the opposer. And the Lord said unto Satan, the Lord rebuke thee, O Satan, even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? Now you remember the account of the burial of Moses. And there was a dispute between Michael and Satan. And Michael said, the Lord rebuked him. In other words, Satan was such a powerful one that even Michael, the archangel, in that time didn't dare to have combat with him. Someday Michael and his angels will finish Satan off, though. That is, they'll throw them out of the heavenly places anyhow. Well, there's Joshua. Now we have a little bit more about him in verse 3. Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the angel. Being the high priest, he is so on representing Israel and representing them as with filthy garments. And he, the angel, or the angel Jehovah, answered and spake unto those that stood before him, saying, take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with change of raiment. Probably might have been said fine linen. Note on that, I believe, or I found one somewhere. So this high priest representing Israel had filthy garments. But the little promise made is that he'll be clothed. In other words, this is a symbol of taking away the iniquity of Israel again. And I said, let them set a fair mitre upon his head. So a mitre is a crown, called a mitre in the case of a priest. So they set a fair mitre, a beautiful one, upon his head, and clothed him with garments, and the angel of the Lord of Jehovah stood by. Now there's the scene. And the angel of the Lord protested unto Joshua, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, if thou wilt walk in my ways, and if thou wilt keep my charge, then thou shalt also judge my house, and shalt keep my courts, and I will give thee places to walk among those that stand by. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, thou and thy fellows that sit before thee, for they are men wondered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant, the branch. In your companion Bible, that's written in large letters. Now, some of you folks listening may have seen at some time the Maseroth. You've seen it in The Witness of the Stars, or The Gospel in the Stars, or possibly my own set of slides, and the tape recording goes with it. But you remember in the first one of the 12 signs that the sun goes through in his journeyings about is Virgo, the Virgin. And in one hand she holds the branch. See, the branch, Christ, came from Virgo, the Virgin. And so he is called the branch. And by the way, the word branch, as far as I've been able to find, is never used in the Bible excepting of Christ. Well, I will bring forth my servant the branch. Well, that is quite a prophecy. And these people who knew, still knew or remembered the gospel in the stars would know right away what he was talking about. For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the graving thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. Now, we have seven eyes mentioned in the first chapter of the Revelation. Seven spirits, and so on. And so here is a little symbol. A stone shall be seven eyes. Now, a stone would be a precious stone, one of the stones that would probably be in the ephod of the priest, that is, a breastplate. And they'd be engraved in that stone seven eyes, which would look in all directions with them. He says, behold, I will engrave the graving thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. Now you'll have some prophecy there. There was iniquity removed in that one day that Christ died on Calvary. The iniquity of Israel. He died for their sins, but you see, they didn't accept. So there's another day coming when they that have pierced him will look upon him. And they will be ready to say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. So we have different days that are looked forward to. Now you can see, since we live way on this side of the birth of Christ, almost 2,000 years, we can look back and see and understand more of these prophecies than the folks ever could hope to whom they were given, unless they had an explanation given to them, which sometimes they did have. It's so much easier to explain a prophecy after it's been fulfilled, you know. It's the ones that haven't been fulfilled are the ones that bothers. And then the 10th verse. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, shall ye call every man his neighbor under the vine and under the fig tree. Now, the thee means his own. And we have this repeated in Micah 4. Now, to sit under. The note says to invite to sit down and feast. Or, just as the picture is, that in peace a man could go out and sit under his fig tree, nobody to bother and to threaten him in any way. That's a sign of peace and prosperity. That a man can have his own little piece of ground, sit under his own fig tree, and have his vine. And of course, after all, these are symbolical. The Israel is spoken of as the vine and the fig and the olive. And what's time to have? So when we take these up as symbols, and many, many years ago, Dr. Bullinger wrote a book on the fig, the olive, and the vine, showing the different aspects of Israel's blessings and so on. It's rather worth thinking about. Of course, in Romans 11, why we have the olive tree spoken of it correctly, because that had to do with Israel's blessings. The oil from the olive was white blessings. Now, we'll have to start with chapter 4 the next time here in Zechariah, next week, I hope. It'll take just a minute here to readjust and get ready for the next part. Be ready then to start the next section. Okay, now I would like to take up a little different type of study tonight for our second section of the lesson. John Baptist.